The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, how on earth do you condense the revelations of modern physics into just 78 pages? Carlo Rovelli's Seven Brief Lessons on Physics is an attempt to do just that. The book conveys the beauty and mystery of physics and has a poetic quality that has already enticed many readers on the continent. Carlo Rovelli joins us in the pod to discuss the implications of modern physics. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Carlo Rovelli is an Italian theoretical physicist and writer who currently works in Marseille. His work is mainly in the field of quantum gravity, where he is among the founders of the loop quantum gravity theory. His book, Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, has sold more copies in Italy than any other book, 50 Shades of Grey included, and it's just been published in English. Carlo, your book brings together a series of articles you wrote for an Italian newspaper. What were you hoping for people to go away with after reading this series of articles or the book now?
I guess mainly that science is beautiful, is fascinating, is passionating, and that it's not too hard if you just try to communicate the core of a scientific idea instead of all the details that go around it.
Your book's been hugely popular both in Italy and it's, you know, going down quite well over here. Your approach is, as you were saying there, to keep things brief and to get kind of straight to the nub of a theory in quite a clear, direct fashion. Do you feel that popular science books in general have just become too technical, too verbose, too kind of bogged down in too much detail?
Well, there are different kind of audiences, right? There are the young kids fascinated by science who want to know all the details. So it's good that there are books that give all the details. You know, there are particles, how many, which variety, which forces, all these details. But there are many people who, you know, there are 15 particles, 16, what's the matter of the... I think that a good scientific theory, when it's digested, is simple. The Earth is not the center of the world. It goes around the sun. That's it, period. I mean, to get there, you need observations, you need mathematics, you need reasoning. It's a long, long story. Or all living beings have common ancestors, period. To get there again, I mean, you have to go around the world and write a long book and argue, and it's a long story, which you're going to be. But at the end, the core message of the best science is simple, and I try to do that, just focus on the core message of quantum mechanics, general relativity, quantum gravity.
And the topics you cover, you pick seven topics to touch on in your book, and they run from the perhaps more predictable, you know, quantum theory, Einstein's work, through to consciousness and quantum loop gravity, which a lot of people maybe would be surprised to come across in this sort of very short introduction to physics. But were they for you the sort of fundamental principles you wanted to convey? What was the rationale behind the topics that you chose?
The rationale is that the beauty of science, in my opinion, is not just what we have learned, is also what we don't know. Science puts us in front of mysteries, of things we don't know. And the great fascination is there, at the boundary between what we know and what we don't know. So the majority of the book, it's about the great revolution in physics in the 20th century and what we actually have convincingly found out about the world. But then there are the last, I would say, three chapters in which I talk what we're trying to do now, what is the next step, and what are the open questions. Of course, making clear that this we know, this we're trying. Then there's the last chapter, which is different. And it's not really about physics. It's about how I think we as human beings can see ourselves in this strange, funny world, world of physics, made of curved space, jumping particles. And so what are we, our consciousness, our view of the world within the physical world?
That gets very philosophical, and some of the questions you ask are certainly kind of quite quite profound questions. At one point you ask, what is the present? Which is a question I think most of us would sort of just be completely floored by. Do you think that philosophy is an important and perhaps even overlooked aspect of a scientist's quest to understand our world?
Absolutely, yes. The great scientists from Newton to Faraday to Einstein to Heisenberg were deeply influenced the philosopher. In turn, they influenced philosophy enormously. And the questions they addressed sometimes overlap very much with questions addressed by philosophers. There's a direct intersection between what Kant says about space and time and what Einstein says about space and time, some contradictions and some getting together things, but certainly a commonality of interest and questioning. More than that, I think that modern science sometimes risks to become sterile by not being aware of the philosophical implications of the philosophical issues about its own methodology and so on. So there isn't a clear boundary. There is, of course, a boundary. Scientists do their job and philosophers do their job, and they shouldn't step on one another too much. But the more they listen to one another, the better it is for both, in fact.
You clearly find physics both intellectually stimulating, but also sort of beautiful and inspiring, as you sort of mentioned earlier. And some of your passages are sort of quite poetical. I mean, do you think that there is a marriage to be made between sort of science and perhaps very expressive, creative writing and other sort of forms of art as well?
I do. Once again, there are different methods, there are different styles, there are different aims. It's superficially confusing things is always bad. But having said so, what a good writer of novels, or what a good artist, what a good visual artist does, is to, in my opinion, is largely to create new ways of looking at the world and giving us new eyes for looking at the world. So he creates concepts, images that, when they work, they enlarge our capacity of seeing around. Right? You read Shakespeare, and you get a strong emotion. And also, you know more about humans then. And then you look at humans differently because you have a larger spectrum of concepts for thinking about humanity. Well, it's exactly the same with Einstein. You study Einstein, you get an emotion which is comparable, because I think the intensity of the emotion that you get when you discover and finally fully understand that space is not what you thought it is, and time is not what you thought it is, and matter is not what you thought it is. It's comparable to seeing the Sistine Chapel. I mean, it's a wow, ooh, ee. And after this, you look at the world in a different manner, which of course is larger in the sense that it allows you to do more things. I mean, all our present technology is a consequence of this new eyes that Faraday and Maxwell have given to us to see the world. Now we see gravitational electromagnetic waves. Before Faraday and Maxwell, nobody knew about them. Now every electrician who mounts the antenna on the top of your house to see TV thinks in terms of these waves that that go around. So we see more about the world. We know more about the world, both through art and through science.
I wanted to ask you more about this feeling of realization, and you open the book recalling the moment when it sort of dawned on you, some sort of understanding of Einstein's general theory of relativity. I think you were sat on a beach. And
yes.
I wonder if you could just take us through that feeling, what it is like, because you hear other scientists have talked about this kind of thing in the past. Feynman has talked about it, this moment of some kind of deep insight. And it must be something similar when you fully grasp what an equation is telling you. I just wonder if you can help our listeners understand that feeling.
I think that but I think that everybody can experience that, or has experienced that, right? At some point, somebody tell us that the Earth goes around the sun. We just, you know, put it in a corner of our mind and whatever. And then one day you're looking at the sunset, and you're appreciating the beauty, and you suddenly realize that it's not as this big sun is moving and going down, it's you yourself who is rotating and in fact zipping at 10 kilometers per hour in space, and what you're seeing is your own motion explicitly, and suddenly you have a different view of all the things around you. All this stability around us is just disappeared, destroyed, and we are on a sort of spaceship running into space. And you say, "Wow, I've got it! I understand exactly what it means." You have understood what Copernicus and all the way to Newton have understood. You have understood deeply. Now it's part of your perception of the world. It changes your common sense view of things. Now you understand that to move or not to move is a more complicated thing than what you used to think. You understand that up and down, it's a really different. Or when you realize that in Sydney, people live head down and feet up, and nevertheless they don't fall. I mean, I think every child goes through this experience. When you actually interiorize this, is a new vision of the world. And the more you physics does that. The beauty of physics is this: it challenges your common sense, not because it's wrong. I mean, there's still up and down, but it gives you a larger view. Science is that, right? It's not just mathematical equations to make machines and make predictions and compute stuff. There's also that, of course. But the core aspect is this changing view of the world. The beginning of the book, there is I tell the story of myself, because I think that's the best way of introducing general relativity, Einstein's beautiful theory. I tell the story of myself studying it. I was at the beach in the south in Italy in front of the sea. And I suddenly began to see that space curves and time curves, understand what it means, and it was a great emotion.
I wanted to ask you, though, actually, especially in the early part of the book, you sort of seem rather scathing of the way that we teach science. You know, it's sort of you say about your student accommodation being a kind of refuge from the lecture halls, and about how people don't allow students to sort of waste time in the way that perhaps that used to be more common in the past. Do you think that we should change the way that physics is taught, the science is taught?
Well, yes and no. I do say that Einstein became a great scientist by dropping out of school and spending 1 year doing nothing. I do say that the best periods for learning is when you're in vacation periods, because you're not distracted by school, so you can finally learn, and things like that. It's a big tongue-in-cheek, of course, but it's there's a grain of truth. We cannot do without school, obviously, but we cannot do just with school. School is it's an opportunity. It just points out where are the interesting things, and there are many. Okay, so I see school as a list of interesting aspect of our civilization, whether it's art of literature or science or mathematics or chemistry or whatever. But then, school is not the best way for really understanding something. I think that every good student knows that the best way to learn something is just go home and forget what the teacher said and read a book and think about things, look at things, look at the world, and that's how you learn.
When you start off the book with looking at Einstein's general theory, you describe it as beautiful, and I'm wondering why that equation stands out for you.
It's the only equation I put in the book. It's a single equation, which I don't describe. I don't go into this term is this, term is that. But I found it fantastic that a single idea, a single fantastic idea that Einstein had, and a single equation, there's a gap between the two. Einstein took 10 years to go from the idea to the actual formalization of it into the equation. Suddenly, did open for us this incredibly new world, this black hole, exploding universe, gravitational waves, immensity of space-time. Space is closed into itself, has no boundary. All this magic, it just come out from something you can write in a line, in a single line. This is extraordinary. This is what I find fascinating, especially in generativity. Generativity is an incredible theory. It just says that space and time curve, which, you know, takes some time to understand what it means. I use the first 10 pages of the book to try to say exactly what it means. And once this idea is clear, and once this is put into the simple equation, which basically says that in a precise manner, then there are all these predictions that come out from this equation. The equation was written 100 years ago. In fact, 99 years and 11 months ago. Nobody expected, Einstein less than anybody else, that from this equation would come out all these incredible predictions, like black holes, gravitational waves, and so on, which I mentioned. Einstein himself didn't believe what came out from his equation at the beginning. And everything that has come out from this equation so far has been verified. It has come out true by astronomers, by measurement, by everything else.
Einstein played a key role in the development of quantum theory and the ideas behind the quantum, but he famously struggled with that idea himself. 100 years on, we're still finding this a pretty baffling theory. Is that because our experience is just not on the quantum level, that we deal with real-world events that are bigger than the quantum level, or are we missing something really big?
It's debated. Some people think one way, some scientists think one way, some scientists think the other way. I tend to think that the first answer is the right one, namely, the difficulty of understanding quantum theory is not understanding quantum theory, is dislearning our classical way of thinking. And that's often the case in science. The difficulty is not getting new ideas. New ideas are cheap. I mean, plenty of new ideas. It's getting rid of the old ideas. That's the hard part. Because our brain is sort of almost wired, but not hardwired, it's softwired, to think the world in some manners. And to accept the idea that the world is not like that, so to be able to think of the world differently, takes a lot of effort. Perhaps, I may be wrong, but perhaps it's true, quantum mechanics is still mysterious and strange because particles are not particles, because things are here but are also there at the same time. And what does it mean? Because then when we look at them, they're only in one place. It's counterintuitive, it's strangely counterintuitive. It tells us that we cannot get rid of interactions when we describe the world. We don't describe objects, we describe only how objects affect one another. So it describes the world more as a process, as a web of interactions, rather than a set of things. And this is a big jump. But I think it's a jump that we will get used to. And I think that in another generation, people will think about quantum mechanics in the same manner we think about, people in Sydney living upside down. Funny, but that's the way it is.
I wanted to ask you more about how we should see the structure of space. Well, you have a chapter looking at the cosmos and so on. I think people can get their heads around, hopefully now, you know, the idea of fields, electromagnetic fields and things like this. These are things that we become pretty familiar with through our schooling. But the structure of space is still a tough one, the idea that space itself is a structure. How should we think of it?
It's good that you formulate the question this way, because I think that field is the key answer to your question. Generativity is hard to digest unless you first digest what Faraday and Maxwell did, namely introducing this field notion. A field is a real entity. It's not some way of describing something else. It's not a manner of coding forces. It's a stuff. It's Faraday lines that go all over the field over the space. So a field is an entity, but it's not a particle-like entity. It's a diffused entity, which is all over. And Einstein's fantastic idea is that space, we have this idea of empty space, right? Is not a funny space entity, but it's a field. It's nothing else but a field. So the step to understanding generativity are two. First, digest all the way through what Maxwell and Faraday did. Accept the idea that in nature there are fields. And then the next step is easier. Space is just a field. It's a gravitational field. So there isn't a gravitational field on space. It's space itself, which is a gravitational field. Einstein used this beautiful metaphor of the molluscus, the jellyfish. We're immersed in an immense jellyfish, which is this moving space that can be squeeze and bend and stretch. Okay, because it's like an electromagnetic wave. It's something real, which has its own dynamic. It moves. And is what determines distances between me and you. Now there's 2 meters, But it can stretch by itself, not because you and I move, because in between it can be stretched. Or this is what happened when a gravitational wave goes through.
Carlo, that leads us on to your chapter on particles, where you go through the sort of the various fundamental particles that are known about. Can you give us again some sort of thoughts on how we should see particles? Because we, again, through schooling, we are sort of, you know, taught to think of these very simplistically as little spheres, microscopic spheres, whatever type of particle it is. But are these sort of no more than ripples in fields? What is it that determines where a particle starts and where it ends, if you're talking about a fundamental particle? What is really the nature of these things?
Particles are described by quantum field theory, by quantum mechanics. The interesting aspect of particle theory, of high energy theory, as it's called, is not that there are this particle, this other particle, and this other particle, but is exactly what you said. These are not particles in the sense of little stones, of little grain of sand, entities that behave in a totally an intuitive way for us. They're like flickering, appearing and disappearing things out of the continuous, which is the field. They have something in common with waves. Waves on the sea is something that can appear, disappear, is spread out, is not in one. But they are not waves either. They are quantum objects. And a quantum object is something that, first of all, behaves probabilistically. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, even if we know exactly where it is and how it is now. More importantly, it manifests itself by interacting with something else. So, in a sense, particles are the manner the field interact with something else. And that's the conceptual jump, which is difficult to take. Instead of describing the world as, okay, this is a list of objects, and that's how they move, quantum mechanics describe the world as this is how a piece of the universe interact with another piece of the universe. This is how it affects it. And if you try to ask, yes, but how is this piece of universe just by itself, independently of the interaction? Quantum mechanics is basically doesn't answer to this question. That's a mystery of quantum mechanics. So to some extent, it's saying that's a wrong question. There's no meaning of a thing in itself. There's only meaning of a thing in interaction. So these particles are more like a net of things that affect one another and affect us when you look at the particle, of course. I think that at the world, like a screen of an old style television set where there is all these flickering things appearing and disappearing, I think that's the closest metaphor or image we can give about particles. The beauty is that that's us. I mean, our solid tables, our self, our thinking, and the planets and the stars and the sea and the sunsets is just these flickering particles interacting with one another.
I'm still kind of a bit intrigued though by about what defines them in terms of what, you know, where one does start and finish. I mean, if I'm thinking about, say, an electron as, say, an excitation in an electric field, does that mean that there are this entire field is full of these excitations, and are they moving past each other, and are they sort of more concentrated in some places than others? It's I'm trying to get my head around sort of, you know, what we're in that frame of mind and from that point of view constitutes a particle, and what has created it and defined it in a particular space. Does it not exist if it's not interacting with something?
I think in terms of these fields and excitation of the fields, as you said. First of all, you said correctly. I mean, photons are excitation of the electromagnetic field, and electrons are the same thing. They are excitation of a field. Okay, technically called the Dirac field, is electron field in a sense. So imagine a sea or lake. Okay, where the lake can move, can shake. However, every time you put your hand in the lake and you want to feel the up and down of the waves, you only get discrete bumps, one at a time, and never a continuous thing. So you say, oh, well, the lake is made by grains, by particles, by chunks. But then between once you're hit by one chunk and the next one, it's very hard and is impossible, and if you get wrong, if you try to believe that this particle is somewhere. So the particle is the way you're hit you know, I don't know. It's like if you and I are fighting and you hit me and then we move again and you hit me again. I can't say where is the hit between the two. Maybe one time you hit me with your hands and another time with your foot. So the only thing I get is hit, these kicks. And that's what we get from the field. So we get discrete kicks. And the particles are not what is in between, are the individual kicks.
You discussed the theory of loop quantum gravity and the idea that space, like energy, has discrete quanta, which is sort of a quite mind-boggling notion to come into. What does that actually mean? I mean, in terms of sort of, because we experience space obviously as a continuum. So what does it mean, this idea that it's quantized?
It means the same thing that it means for matter, right? We know from structure of matter, we know from chemistry. In fact, the chemists realized much before than the physicists, that matter is made by atoms. We have all the time experience of pieces of matter or a glass of water. Water looks continuous, but we know that it's not. I mean, we cannot cut it more than a finite number of times. At some point, we get to a single water molecule, and that's it. I mean, then it's not water anymore. The idea that the space between you and I is continuous and can be cut an infinite number of time, it's a mathematical idea. It's not something in our experience. In our experience, we never cut space an infinite number of time. We can perceive space up to not more than a small fraction of a millimeter. With the best machines we have, we can get, I don't know, to 10 to the minus 16 or 17 millimeters or whatever. This doesn't imply in any sense that we can keep cutting space in smaller and smaller space forever. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you really think about it, it's totally logical that we would be able to. It would mean that in the smallest possible portion of space you can imagine, there is still room enough for an entire universe with galaxies. That's not possible. We don't believe that, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the alternative? I think the alternative is what comes naturally from quantum mechanics and general relativity together, which is quantum gravity, which teaches us that space is granular. So when we mean that between you and I there are 3 feet, we mean that there's a certain number of grain of space. It's a finite number of grain of space, and there's no meaning of cutting more. But let me make a clear difference. We are talking here not about physics, which is well established, and on which there's consensus, everybody agree, we have made experiment, and we're talking about what we're trying to see sort of beyond the boundary of what we have learned well. General relativity, we have well understood it, it's pretty clear once you understand it, and has been confirmed by an incredibly wealth of observation. Quantum mechanics is not completely clear, right? If what I said about quantum mechanics not clear, is not your fault while listening is the fault of the physicists who have made it more clear than that. But it's totally consensual, and it has been confirmed by innumerable experiments, and is at the basis of our technology. Quantum gravity is what we think it's going on, and we're not sure yet.
You mentioned one of the ways of trying to probe this is to look at black holes and to look at what happens if black holes kind of collapse and the matter inside black holes continues to shrink and shrink and shrink until it gets this very, very small point, and then it will re-explode. The black hole will explode. Can you tell me a bit about that? And where are we in trying to observe that process, observing exploding black holes? Is that, have we ever seen anything, or were we likely to ever see anything along those lines?
Okay, the right answer is we don't know. we are really in the dark. The story is this. Black holes are prediction of general relativity. People didn't believe they really existed until the 70s, and then they were discovering the sky exactly like they were predicted by general relativity. Now astronomers treat them like, pieces of bread, normal things which are there. They measure how big they are, how they rotate, and everything. We observe them, they behave exactly like the theory predicts. It's normal objects. Black holes is something that everything falls in, nothing comes out. And according to general relativity, they're stable. Once they're formed, there's no way to destroy them. But, and that's the point, the theory doesn't say what happened inside the black hole in the very center. The theory says what happened outside the black hole, on the surface of the black hole, mm-hmm. It's called the horizon of the black hole, inside. and inside, but not at the very center. At the very center, the theory just doesn't work. And this is crucial because we see everything falling into a black hole. It falls, it goes to the center. So we have all these things falling in a hole and no idea what happened to this thing. That's the actual state of knowledge of humanity today about black holes. Great confidence about outside, zero information about the real center. Why? Well, because inside quantum mechanics becomes non-negligible. So it's really a problem of quantum gravity. It's quantum mechanics that becomes relevant in a gravitational thing. So this is the story. And now we have tentative theories of gravity. I mean, I work in loop quantum gravity, which is exactly an attempt to describe these grains of space, these quanta of space-time. So we use this theory, this tentative theory, to try to guess what, try to predict what actually happens inside the black hole. And a recent idea, we're talking about last year or something like that, is that what happens is not so hard. In fact, it's pretty simple, is that matter falls inside and then bounces out. And this is impossible classically, but it would be possible because there's quantum mechanics, which in fact changes the behavior of... I love this idea. And the reason I love this idea is because it's based on the great change of what time is. Because time slows down inside a black hole. It slows down dramatically. So if you have a star that collapses, if you are on the star, you follow very rapidly to the center of the black hole, and then what happens is the simplest of all things. It bounces up and explodes. Mm-hmm. But if you're outside, because of the time difference between the inside and the outside, because of time changes with altitude and so on and so forth, from the outside, the same process takes millions of years. Mm-hmm. So a black hole, if this is correct, is really a bouncing star, a star that collapses, goes down to a point and explodes, seeing at an incredibly slow motion. Okay? And then we, if this is right, they should be exploding black holes. It takes a long time. So the one we might be able to see are the very old black holes, the one formed in the early universe. And we have made some calculations and predicted the kind of signal that should come out. And now we are super excited. Of course, we might be wrong. And let me say it clear. We might be wrong. We are very excited because some signals that astronomers, radio astronomers, receive from the sky, have received from the sky, the signals are called fast radio burst. They are just some burst in the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum, are very similar to what we have predicted. So we are there saying, well, I mean, are these signals really exploding black holes through a quantum gravity process? I hope they are. maybe they're not, but this, you know, that's science.
This brings us on to the idea of the big bounce rather than the big bang, as you talk about in the book, about the idea that our universe came from a previous universe that contracted and then blew apart in a sort of similar process.
It's the same process.
And are you sort of seduced by the idea of a multiverse at all? I mean, is that, how does that fit into this?
Well, thank you for formulating the question that way. No, I'm not. I'm not at all seduced by the idea of the multiverse. Several of my colleagues are. Of course, I respect them enormously. I think we don't really have information about that or way of checking about that. So it's good to speculate. Science is about speculation. But the speculations shouldn't be too wild. Should always be... They're meaningful in science when you can say, okay, I speculate this and this, and therefore I predict this, and this can be checked. That's what makes science different than just free dreaming. So, of course, there may be many universes. There may be all sorts of things. You know, there may be, you know, green people with antennas on. But unless we can check, we're not talking about science. And in the multi-universe ideas, for the moment, I don't see a way of checking. The idea that black hole explode excites me, not because it's a beautiful idea by itself, but because it's a possibility to see the signal of the explosion, or maybe that we have seen it already. The day in which my colleague who likes the multi-universe says, look, if this is true, the astronomers are going to say that, then I'll take this very seriously.
You also talk about the idea of hot space. So the fact that Stephen Hawking has calculated that black holes emit heat sort of like an oven. What do we mean by hot space, sort of in terms of quantization? We know that energy is quantized. And we have this idea of sort of energy levels, a bit like a ladder. You know, that's something that we've all sort of come across. But what do we mean when it comes to space and this idea of hot space?
It's all complicated. In this room, there is a certain temperature. And because of that, the electromagnetic field is thermally fluctuating. If you want, the photons are hot a little bit. They jump around like the hot molecules of a hot cup of tea. Okay, so the field itself can get hot, can be excited and go up in its energy levels because there's energy around. The electromagnetic field. There's no reason for the gravitational field to do the same. So for space-time to do the same. So this means that the space between me and you, and I believe this is a strong consequence of what we know, is cannot avoid to do that. Space between me and you, precisely because it's a molluscus that can move, since there is heat, it should vibrate and fluctuate rapidly because of its temperature. So we need a way to describe the temperature and the heat of space itself, this moving, rapidly moving of space itself, like we have a way of describing the heat of the electromagnetic field. Now, the description of the heat of the electromagnetic field, we have it very well. It's black body radiation. It was worked out at the beginning. In fact, Einstein contributed to it, Planck, and so on. And it was key to understanding quantum mechanics. It's one of the way we got to quantum mechanics. The temperature of the heat in gravity, the heat of space-time, we believe is there, but we don't know how to describe it. If we try to write equations, we get confused. So I see this one of the great mysteries of physics. And Hawking did this fantastic calculation in the 70s. It's the best thing he did in theoretical physics. He, in fact, was able to show that a black hole is like a radiator. It just emits heat, all sort of radiation, and he was able to calculate the temperature of a black hole, showing that, there is a strict connection between quantum mechanics, thermodynamics, and general relativity, space-time, heat, and the quantum. These three pieces of our knowledge of the world, the three big castles of our physical knowledge, and we can't bring the three together. So I think the mystery is not just quantum gravity, the great mystery, but the mystery is quantum and gravity and heat. And the day will, I hope, before dying, to see a theory in which they all make sense together.
When dealing with the concept of time, you mention Einstein's letter to Michaela Besso's sister following Besso's death, in which he refers to the passage of time as an illusion. Are you saying that basically it's only statistically unlikely that we can, in fact, see backwards into time?
In some sense, it's a bit stretching, but in some sense, yes. What time is changes enormously in theoretical physics. It did change in special relativity, changes more in general relativity, changes even more in quantum gravity. In quantum gravity, the fundamental equation of quantum gravity is no time. Time emerges from the motion of everything in a way which involves statistics. That's what I think. In fact, only when there is heat around, we can distinguish the past from the future. Mechanical thing, without heat, don't distinguish the past from the future. If you take a movie of something purely mechanical and project it backward, it's perfectly reasonable physics. But if you take a movie and you project it backward and there is something strange, sure, there is heat somewhere. Okay, so heat has to do with time in some manner, but heat means probability, movement, so means approximation. So in some sense, time comes only some approximation. Now, the sentence of Einstein's can easily be misled. Time is an illusion, meaning it's an illusion if we think that is a fundamental thing of reality. Right. Philosophers sometimes bash physicists. They say, come on, you cannot say time is illusion. Time is real. Of course it's real. It's real for us. We have a certain amount of time for this conversation and it's finite and that's real. But it's like up and down, right? Up and down are real. I cannot walk on the ceiling, but up and down are not global things of the universe, a local thing. So perhaps, I believe, time is also a local thing here. It's not a fundamental thing of the universe.
Can you elaborate on this point in the book where you say a sort of hyperlogical person or hyperintelligent person would be able to see time as in its almost in its entirety as past, present and future, all as one huge sort of possibility or something? I'm interested in how you get to that point. What would I, if I could, what would I gain from it? How would the world look to me if I didn't worry so much about just being in the present and being aware of my past and the future being something yet to happen? These sort of, you know, these things not in existence.
First of all, let me make clear, because this has been blamed on me. I don't believe that this being, seeing everything exists, right? So if I'm an atheist, I don't believe that there is this person looking at everything. What I meant is that if the notion of time, the sense of a flowing time, is related to heat, and therefore is related to probability, is related to an approximate view of the world, we describe a cup of tea as hot, because we make an average on the motion of the molecules, and we don't we don't look at the detail of all the individual motion. If we gave a completely total information of all possible position of the molecules, we would know from that the past or the future of the cup of tea entirely. It's only when we take this approximation that we get this flowing sense and this loss of information into heat and so on and so forth, the second law of thermodynamics. So what I meant is that simply it is because we interact with the rest of the world in a limited manner, we only limited information about the rest of the world, which we experience a second law of thermodynamics and the flowing of time. Metaphorically, if we could know all the variables, the knowledge of a present would be equivalent of the total knowledge of the future and the past. That's what I meant, no more than that.
Carlo, in the very end of the book, you're talking more about what it is to be human and our place in the world and our place in the universe and things like this. You're getting sort of more away from the science, I suppose. And in that chapter, I noticed that you seem to be a little bit pessimistic about our chances for survival as a species. You don't seem to think that Homo sapiens has got that much of a future. I'm wondering where your pessimism comes from.
I don't know if it is pessimism or realism. We are a species which is very young. We're making a lot of damage on the Earth, as we know very well. Each of us is aware that personally we're going to die. It's not impossible that our species is going to die. I think we have simply to accept this as a possibility. There are species like the turtles, which have been living for millions of years on Earth. We don't seem that kind of things. We are more similar to the other species of the Homo genus, which have disappeared very rapidly. I hope no, of course. I mean, and we have a chance. We are smart, of course. We can sometimes try to correct, precisely because we are intelligent and rational, we have manners, we have more tools to correct the damage that we do. But we're not so smart. We're not so intelligent, after all. Just sufficient to listen to the news and to see this confirmed. And so we might very well find ourselves in big troubles. In a sense, it was more than expressing pessimism, was also a way to contribute to the awareness that we should better take care of the future if we're interested in it.
So are we smart enough to be dangerous to ourselves, but not smart enough to save ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, many past civilizations collapsed badly because they did damage to themselves, from the Maya to even the Greek civilization collapsed in that many way, and many others. But, you know, I think it's fine. In the last chapter of the book, the main idea I'm trying to express is just we are part of this nature that we describe with science. We are not outside it. We are part, which means that we have limitation, which means we are just things made by jumping quirks and fields and stuff. Nature is fantastically rich. It produces marvelous things, galaxy cells, and it produces us, our brain. Nature is more rich than we thought. I mean, the difficulty of thinking ourselves a part of nature is because we often downplay nature. We think nature is just stones jumping around. No, nature is rich. It produces also us. But that means also we are vulnerable. We are not of a different realm that the things around us. To me, it also means that it is reassuring. We are not strangers in this natural world. We are just home in this natural world. And so I like this way of being part of nature.
Carlo Rovelli. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Carlo Rovelli and to Nicola Davis. From me, Ian Sample, and all the Science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.